This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of Canada, A Yearly Journey. Before we begin today's episode, I'd like to take a moment to talk about dogs. Dogs have been an important part of Canadian history from the very beginning. The first dogs to arrive in Canada came from Siberia over 12,000 years ago. They were used for hunting, pulling sleds, and as companions for the indigenous people who made their way across the Bering Strait. In the 17th century, European settlers brought dogs with them as well. And like the indigenous people, they relied on their dogs for companionship, hunting, and protection. Dogs have been some of Canada's most beloved heroes. In 1909, a Labrador retriever named Polar Bear helped the explorer Robert Peary reach the North Pole. In 1916, Canadians were captivated by the story of Bruno, a sheepdog who was rescued from war-torn Europe and refused to eat after his person passed away. In 1941, a Newfoundland named Gander saved the lives of several Canadian soldiers during the Battle of Hong Kong. Over the centuries, dogs have served Canadians in an ever-expanding variety of ways. Today, they work in law enforcement, detect cancer and COVID, help find missing children, and enable the blind to get around. But for most Canadians, dogs are much more than just working animals. Their loyalty, friendship, and unconditional love have made them part of our families. Countless dogs are beloved characters in Canadian art and film. Their stories have been told by such noteworthy authors as Farley Mowat, Lucy Maud Montgomery, and Stephen Leacock. They can make us laugh, they comfort us, they remind us of our better angels, of what our character could be. And perhaps that is why we love them so much. Which brings me to my puppy, Boris. Boris is a 10-year-old Irish Setter Newfoundland cross, the same breed as Gander, actually. Recently, he began hacking up his food. His bark became raspy, and he's having trouble breathing deeply, so I took him to see the vet. Boris has the canine version of Lou Gehrig's disease. His spinal cord will slowly degenerate, and over the next 1 to 3 years, he will progressively lose control of the muscles he uses to play, bark, eat, and breathe. There is no cure, and the cause remains unknown. But there is a way to slow it down. With the laryngeal paralysis, Boris needs surgery. Without it, his constricted larynx will get worse faster, and he may pass away in only a few months. The problem is the surgery costs $5,000, which is well beyond what I can afford. So I'm asking for your help. I've set up a GoFundMe to pay for the vet. If you'd like to contribute, just click the link for Boris Fundraiser in my show notes. And if you've donated already, thank you. If you've shared, thank you as well. Thank you for helping us get a few more precious years together, because it means the world to us both. As Canada marched through the first part of its second decade, the country began to expand and face several challenges unlike anything it had seen before. So let's begin our look at Canada in 1873. On January 10th, George Orton was born. He would go on to become the first Canadian to win a medal at the Olympic Games when he won bronze on the 400-meter hurdles in 1900, followed 45 minutes later by a gold in the 2500-meter steeplechase. He would go on to set a then record of 17 national running titles in the United States, win the U.S. 1-mile championship 6 times, and would set a mile record of 4 minutes 21 seconds that lasted for 42 years. In his career, he won 131 races, including 33 national and international championships. He would pass away in June of 1958. 9 days later, on January 19th in Woodstock, Thomas Petullo would be born. He would go on to become the Premier of British Columbia, serving from 1933 to 1941. Another Olympian was born this year for Canada when Étienne Desmarteau was born on February 4th in Boucherville. A police officer in 1904, he was denied leave to compete in the Olympics, so he quit his job and left anyways. He would go on to win the gold medal that year in weight throwing. When he returned, he was rehired immediately, but would sadly pass away in 1905 from typhoid fever. He is generally considered to be our first true Olympic champion because George Orton was competing for an American university when he won his medal in 1900. On February 26, Gédéon Aumont would become the Premier of Quebec. He would serve as the second Premier of the province from 1873 to 1874, before he had to resign as a party leader due to the tannery scandal, which had severe implications for the Quebec government. The scandal had seen the government exchange land worth $200,000 for a farm west of Montreal worth less than $40,000. An organizer for the party had received $65,000 in the deal, and several members of the government were implicated in the deal. I'm actually looking at every election in Quebec's history over on my other podcast, From John to Justin, in September, so be sure to check it out. On April 1st, Prince Edward Island had its first provincial election just prior to becoming part of Canada. James Pope would be elected and be the first provincial premier of the province after the island joined Confederation. Also on April 1st, the SS Atlantic would be wrecked off Peggy's Cove. The Atlantic was an ocean liner belonging to the White Star Line that ran between Liverpool and New York. On its 19th voyage, it hit rocks and sank off the coast of Nova Scotia. Of the 952 people aboard, including 835 passengers, 535 people would die, making it the deadliest civilian maritime disaster in the North Atlantic Ocean at the time. It would also be the worst disaster for the company until the loss of the Titanic in 1912. Every woman and every child, except for one 12-year-old boy, would die. On April 2nd, the Pacific scandal would erupt when 150 members of the Conservative government took bribes in an attempt to influence the bidding for a national railway contract. It's likely that no one would have ever found out about the scandal, at least for the time, if not for the fact that Sir Hugh Allan wrote a lot of letters and kept all of them. While Allan was in England with his lawyer, future Prime Minister John Abbott, his private secretary, George Norris, and another man stole the letters that Allan had left with Abbott for safety. These letters, once leaked to the public, show that there was an agreement between Sir John A. Macdonald, Sir George Etienne Cartier, and Sir Hugh Allan that assured Allan of the railway contract in return for campaign funds. Norris would sell the letters to the Liberal Party for $5,000, and on April 2, 1873, the scandal erupted in the House of Commons when L.S. Huntington, the Liberal MP for Shefford, brought forward his charges. That the Americans feel aggrieved that they are not to be permitted to control the Canadian Pacific Railway is perhaps natural. That Sir Hugh Allan, in his negotiations with them, may have held out hopes, which are now disappointed, is not at all improbable. But Parliament has surely something else to do than avenge the personal wrongs of these people. End quote. Soon after the scandal became known, Macdonald had a parliamentary committee organized to investigate the allegations of conflict of interest and corruption. The creation of a parliamentary committee was not greeted with enthusiasm by some outlets. Le National would write on May 29, 1873, quote, "Whether Sir Hugh Allan subscribed towards election funds or not, we are not aware. Being a wealthy man and politically in sympathy with the government, he certainly ought to have subscribed, just as Mrs. Brown and Holton and Huntington and Laflamme and hosts of others have subscribed money to aid in ousting the administration and placing themselves of their friends on the treasury benches. It does not require a parliamentary committee to prove that wealthy men of a party contribute to the funds necessary for carrying on a great electoral campaign." End quote. The campaign would meet in July of 1873, and letters and telegrams that had been purchased by the Liberal Party soon began to appear in newspapers. One of the most incriminating telegrams was from Sir John A. Macdonald to Sir John Abbott. It states, quote, "I must have another 10,000. Will be the last time of calling. Do not fail me. Answer today." End quote. Another letter from Allan to the American stated that he would be made president of the CPR in exchange for monetary conditions. Soon seeing that the writing was on the wall and the scandal was not going away, Macdonald would meet with Lord Dufferin in August, the Governor General of Canada, and ask that Parliament be suspended. Lord Dufferin agreed to suspend Parliament for 10 weeks, but he stated to Macdonald, quote, "Your personal connection with what has passed cannot but fatally affect your position as minister." End quote. In the House of Commons in November, Macdonald would state, quote, "I have spoken of the suspension of Parliament. I believe that it was constitutional. I believe that it was wise, and whether it was wise or unwise, it was sanctioned by this Parliament, and I know that this Parliament cannot, without dishonor, reverse their vote, and I believe, and I know that this House accepted that proposition." End quote. By this point, the Pacific scandal was the main news in the country, with entire sections of newspapers featuring, in bold letters, the newest developments when it came to news of the scandal. On October 23rd, the House of Commons would reconvene, and several of the Conservative members of Parliament left the party. Donald Smith, one of the most prominent MPs in the party, would become an independent Conservative. Smith would eventually actually be the president of the CPR, and he is the man who drove in the last spike on the CPR in that famous photo. There was a general consensus that if the Prime Minister had forced a confidence vote early enough, he would have been able to survive it, but that prospect was quickly fading. With his government weakened, Macdonald realized, with Prince Edward Island joining Confederation, that their members of Parliament going against the Conservatives, he could lose a vote against the government. Unfortunately for Macdonald, he sank into gin and despair, and waited for whatever trick the Liberals had up their sleeves. He would make a rallying speech on November 3rd, and he would acknowledge that he promised the presidency to Hugh Allan, telling the House of Commons, quote, "I made that promise, but I wish the House to remember that at the time of the telegram, in which I stated that as he could not form a company before the election, we would form one afterwards out of the two, and we would do what we could to make Sir Hugh Allan president, at the time there had been not one single word said about money," end quote. He would continue speaking of the stealing of the letters, quote, "If we had spies, if we had thieves, if we had men who went to your desk, picked your lock, and stole your notebooks, we would have much stronger evidence than the honorable gentlemen think they have now. We are fighting an uneven battle. We are simply subscribing as gentlemen, while they were stealing as burglars," end quote. In closing, he would look at the time ahead, stating, quote, "I have fought the Battle of Confederation, the Battle of Union, the Battle of the Dominion of Canada. I throw myself upon the House. I throw myself upon the country. I throw myself upon posterity, and I believe that I know that, notwithstanding the many failings in my life, I shall have the voice of this country and this House rallying around me, and if I am mistaken in that, I can confidently appeal to a higher court, to the court of my own conscience and the court of posterity," end quote. On November 5th, Sir John A. Macdonald resigned as Prime Minister. The Liberals would then be invited by Lord Dufferin to form a government, and Alexander Mackenzie became Canada's second Prime Minister. In January of 1874, the Liberal Party won 138 of 206 seats to capture a huge majority. The first act of this new government was to introduce secret ballots at elections to improve the integrity of future elections. I talk about the Pacific scandal in depth on my podcast Coast to Coast, where I look at the building of the Transcontinental Railway, so I encourage you to check it out. The Northwest Mounted Police were created through Parliament on May 23, 1873, following a debate in the House of Commons. With a vote, the Mounted Police Act was passed with the purpose of having a force of mounted police to watch the frontier from Manitoba to the foot of the Rocky Mountains, with headquarters in Winnipeg. Based heavily on the Royal Irish Constabulary, the force and its purpose would change heavily due to the Cypress Hills Massacre, more on that later. With that tragedy, the force was made a priority. The first commissioner of the new force would be George French. He had been born in Ireland and educated at the Royal Military College, and he had come to Canada at the request of the Canadian government in 1871 to become the head of the School of Gunnery. The first officer appointed to the force was Inspector William Jarvis, and he would join the force on September 25, 1873.
For a number of years, television has been giving us a rootin'-tootin' brand of Western justice. The Old West was a place where men were men, and if things needed settling, the Matt Dillons or Ben Cartwrights of the world took on all comers. Have you ever wondered what it was really like bringing the law to the West, particularly here in Canada?
The law, there was no law. You had to coax them and let them see what law was. That was the hardest job. There was no law, but you had to try and coax them to be your friend because you were their enemy, because you were stopping them from doing just as they wanted to do. See the point?
William Henry Walden, 106 years old. Born at Gravesend, England, he joined the Northwest Mounted Police in 1877, after 4 years trailing herds from Texas to the Canadian prairies. He now lives in Winnipeg, but still recalls comrades of those early police patrols from Wood Mountain to Prince Albert.
They were mostly of old country births. English, Scotch, and Irish. You see, and they understood the British law, and they had the respect for their queen. And then when you joined, that was your oath. And it was very strict oath. And then when we got into Winalda, of course, it wasn't so much the Queen as it was the Constitution, the British North America Act. And you had to live, you swore that you'd live and die by it. But that's what you hired for, to enforce the law and do it. And if it come your way, well...
Did you run into any tough encounters at all?
No, I never can't say I ever did. No, there's only once that I was on duty, but I don't think they intended it for me. I was shot at. I was sitting down resting my horse, and I had my lunch, and the first thing, a whiz.
A bullet went over your head?
No, not a bullet, a whiz. You don't know what it was. You see nothing, you hear nothing, only a whiz. And the first thing I knew, I felt somebody touch me. I got it here.
Got shot in the left arm, yeah, didn't
he? And that was so close. Doctor said it was a fraction of an inch more and I'd have died.
You would have bled to death?
Yes. And there's another one. Went right through the bone. I broke it down thing off. And
what, was it an arrow?
An arrow. And then, of course, I just watched up there and couldn't see what was around there. And I was afraid, but I'll get up there, see them on top there.
You hit in the head as well?
Yes,
when you got up?
So I lay down there and went down and got into a creek and washed me on and bound my arms up. And went off, went for camp.
You never saw who shot at you with the arrow?
No, but they wasn't hunting me, or they'd have been a real screaming, you see.
They would have moved in
they'd
on
have
you.
They'd have moved on. So I don't think there was. And see, it wasn't poison arrows either.
But to be hit three times, it would seem that somebody was shooting at you.
They were firing at something, maybe practicing, maybe birds. God only knows. You can do say anything and think what you like, but there's no use accusing anything or anybody unless you are sure. No. The Indians, in all truth to them, they're about as good a person as any white man ever run across.
When you were patrolling, were you by yourself when you're going up to Prince Albert, or were you with another constable?
Well, sometimes we'd have two, sometimes three. It all depends. We'd go out for a piece, then...
Branch off.
Corporal or whoever's in charge would go on there and let us go to a certain district to find out the public and make the note and report the name and public and whether just about location where they were. That's the only way we could find out if there's anybody in there, you see. And that's the way we learned the competence of the people, and they learned to respect it because we were strangers. We come along as a friend. Now do you understand? You see, it's a lot to do. And I tell you, it was a pretty hard job. All weathers, 50 cents a day.
Now on to the Cypress Hills Massacre. I did an episode on this that goes very in-depth on it, so check it out on Canadian History X. In the spring of 1873, a small party of wolfers led by Thomas Hardwick and John Evans were coming back through the area of the Cypress Hills from their winter hunt. Camping near the Teton River, their horses disappeared in the night. The next morning, as they found their horses gone, the wolfers believed they had been stolen by the indigenous. About 40 of the horses had disappeared, and it's possible they had been taken by local Cree, but for the wolfers there was little difference between any indigenous, and they saw all indigenous as the same group. Believing that the indigenous had taken the horses over the border into Canada, they decided to set out to get their horses back. Walking on foot to Fort Benton in the Montana Territory, they were told by authorities that they would not assist them, so Hardwick organized his own expedition to find the horses. A group of 13 men, including some Canadians, set out from the fort and traveled north. Eventually, they would reach the trading post of Abe Farwell, located in the Cypress Hills. Across the creek was the fort of Moses Solomon. The Assiniboine in the area, who had dealt with a harsh winter and were low on food, liked Farwell, but did not trust Solomon, who they said had cheated them. There were reports that even fired at his post. The Assiniboine had come from the north, where one-third of their number had been wiped out by smallpox. While at the trading post, they met George Hammond, a whiskey trader who was friends with Hardwick, and he quickly joined the party in pursuit of the horses. Farwell, for his part, told Evans and Hardwick that the local Assiniboine, led by a man called Little Soldier, had no horses with them. A quick search was conducted of the Assiniboine camp, and the Wolfers' horses were not found. In the night, the Wolfers and whiskey traders began to drink whiskey with some Métis traders who had recently arrived. Farwell remained sober as those around him drank, including Solomon. In the evening, the horse of Hammond wandered off. In the morning of June 1st, Hammond said that Little Soldier and his men had stolen his horse and began to travel to the camp of Little Soldier, telling the other Wolfers to follow him, which they did. Solomon also joined in the march towards the indigenous camp. According to one story of the massacre, Alexis Labondet, one of the Métis in the area, found Hammond's horse had only wandered away. He called towards the men as they rushed towards the Assiniboine camp, but it was too late. What happened next is up for debate, as there's no reliable testimony from the next few hours. What is believed to have happened is that Farwell tried to restrain Hammond to prevent any violence, which he knew was coming. He was unsuccessful in stopping the men from proceeding to the camp. Hammond then approached the tent of Little Soldier and asked him where his horse was. Little Soldier said that he had not stolen the horse, and that it was grazing on a hill nearby. Little Soldier then offered two horses as hostages until Hammond's horse could be found. At this point, Hammond and his party saw the women and children leaving the camp, and the men stripping off their garments, which they interpreted to be a sign of impending battle. The Wolfers quickly lined up at a riverbank 50 yards from the camp, ready to fight. Farwell begged the Wolfers to not start shooting, but instead of listening, Hammond fired his rifle, followed by the rest of the Wolfers, who fired a volley of bullets into the camp. The Assiniboine fired back, but their weapons were inferior, and the Wolfers were protected by the riverbank. The Assiniboine managed to outflank the Wolfers, forcing them to a high cut bank northwest of their position, but this did not prevent the slaughter of the indigenous. By the end of the gunfight, Ed LaGrace, a Wolfer, had been killed, while many Assiniboine were dead. The number is not known officially, but it's believed to be at least 20 people and as many as 30. If 30 were killed, likely twice as many were wounded. Some oral histories say there was as many as 300 people killed. The Wolfer was buried in a wooden coffin that is still located somewhere at the site, while the Assiniboine were left on the ground, with their bones dotting the landscape for years. According to some reports, the camp was rifled through and then burned by the Wolfers. Some of the stories also relate that Little Soldier was killed and his head was put on a pike, while various women were assaulted by the Wolfers. I can't confirm if either of these events happened, which doesn't mean they didn't happen, but they could have also become embellishments on the story amid anti-American anger following the discovery of the massacre by those in eastern Canada later in the year. Another story of the battle states that Farwell had said he would negotiate to get two horses from the camp of Little Soldier, which Hammond would get until his horse was found. While he was negotiating with the Assiniboine, Hammond and the other men took up the position close to the camp. As Farwell left, possibly to tell Hammond what had been agreed to, shots rang out from Hammond's position. In this story, Hammond had attempted to grab two horses from the camp, but he was stopped by an armed warrior, and Hammond returned to the other Wolfers, who all lined up ready to fight. This story also features a variation that Farwell, realizing what was about to happen, told the Assiniboine to scatter. It would be some time before news of the massacre reached Ottawa. It was first reported by Farwell to the authorities in Montana, who then reported it to Washington. The Assiniboine had fled to a Métis camp nearby, and the Métis would relay the news of the massacre to Winnipeg. By August of 1873, news had reached Ottawa from both Winnipeg and Washington. At first, it was believed that the massacre had occurred south of the Canadian border, but soon enough it was found that it was indeed in Canada, and the matter was referred to Ottawa. The Helena Herald ran a headline stating, quote, "Whites on the warpath, 40 lodges wiped out by 16 Kit Carsons," end quote. As the news reached the rest of Canada, anti-Americanism reached a fever pitch in the new country. The newspapers described the Americans as gangsters and scums. The shock that the Americans would commit the crime on Canadian soil angered many, even though Canadians had taken part in the massacre as well. Canadians in eastern Canada were led to believe that the Americans would continually come into Canada to murder people. The newspaper reports also tended to increase the scale of the slaughter, with the Manitoba Free Press reporting more than 40 were murdered in the massacre. No matter what happened, it would lead to a changing of the Northwest Mounted Police, who would begin their march west next year.
One can associate the residential school system with tuberculosis and tuberculosis with the residential school system.
We had indigenous parents, communities, students, church employees, teachers, and individuals who are part of Indian Affairs, like Dr. Peter Henderson Bryce, giving their critiques in their own time.
People hid when the tuberculosis screening came to their communities because they knew that the result of getting screened was that they could be taken away.
I believe a lot of people were used, government officials who just thought they were doing the right thing. They were doing what they were told.
First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples have already told our story. It's now time to tell the other side of the story.
We need to take a serious look at the parts of the system from the past that we may be replicating today.
I'm Maya Foster Sanchez, and this is the story of a national crime. Coming this fall, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On June 1st, Joseph Howe, a former premier of Nova Scotia and a person who initially opposed Nova Scotia's entry in Canada, but would be instrumental in bringing Manitoba in, passed away. He'd been chosen to be the lieutenant governor of Nova Scotia, but died only 3 weeks into his new posting. In June of 1873, the commissioners were ready to meet with the Saulteaux again to talk about Treaty 3, but this time there was an extra urgency for the government as the Canadian Pacific Railway construction was beginning from Lake Superior to Red River. If the commissioners were unsuccessful, it would have jeopardized the building of the railroad at the time. As such, the commissioners were given approval to offer $14 per person for ceding the territory, along with $6 to $10 in annual payments. The new Lieutenant Governor of Manitoba, Alexander Morris, was told to attend the meeting as well. Before leaving, the commissioners were told they could offer a maximum of $15 per head if it came to it. There would be delays in meeting until September 1873, but the Saulteaux then said they wanted more time to discuss the treaty terms. It was not until October 1st that the treaty talks resumed. Lieutenant Governor Morris would tell the Saulteaux, quote, "I give you $10 per head of the population, and for every other year, $5 a head. To the chief men, not exceeding two in each band, we will give $20 a year forever. I will give each of you this year a present of goods and provisions to take you home, and I am sure you will be satisfied." End quote. The Saulteaux discussed the offer for 1 day and came back with a counteroffer. They wanted $50 a year for each chief, $20 for each council member, and $10 for each band member. They also wanted a one-time $15 payment for each band member, along with farming tools and equipment, household items, farm animals, clothing, and fishing supplies. Chief Mawidopanas stated that all of this was for the use of the land, not its ownership. He would say, quote, "All of this is our property where you have come," end quote. He was also aware of the two previous treaties, and he did not want to lose out in negotiating with the government. He would state, quote, "I lay before you our opinions. Our hands are poor, but our heads are rich, and it is riches that we ask so that we may be able to support our families as long as the sun rises and the water runs," end quote. Negotiations would stall until several other chiefs stated they would sign the treaty, breaking away from the other chiefs. Knowing there was a dissension between the chiefs, Morris used this and encouraged the Saulteaux to get together and consider the offer. He then said if they didn't, he would go in and negotiate with each individual band. Eventually, the Saulteaux were persuaded to accept the offer, likely thanks to the influence of the four Métis who joined them, including James McKay, who was a member of Parliament. The commissioners, at the same time, agreed to increase the one-time cash payment from $10 to $12 per family of five, and they also decided to provide funding for farming tools. On October 3rd, negotiations began again, and the Saulteaux found the new terms favorable, but they asked for more goods, which Lieutenant Governor Morris agreed to. They also obtained exclusion from conscription and permission to hunt and fish, and to allow their relatives who lived in the United States to relocate to Canada within 2 years. That day, the treaty was signed. The land covered by Treaty 3 was primarily west of Thunder Bay, just past the Manitoba border, and the largest current community in that area is Kenora, Ontario. On July 1st, Prince Edward Island joined Canada, becoming the latest Atlantic province to join since Confederation brought in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, and it would be another 50 years before Newfoundland joined. 2 years after British Columbia joined Canada, the deadline for the railway construction to begin was fast approaching on July 20, 1873. 2 days prior to this deadline, a symbolic commencement of construction was conducted. Sir John A. Macdonald would also have a survey party run a location line for a portion of the proposed Vancouver Island Railway. He would choose Esquimalt as the terminus for the railroad. At this point, the route for the railroad had not even been decided upon and would not be for another 5 years. Also at this point, having minimally fulfilled its first promise regarding construction, the government went back to the inaction regarding the railroad. The provincial and federal governments began to argue back and forth over the question of relaxing the 10-year timeline, but this only created more deadlock. We'll talk more about this through the 1870s. On August 25th, a cyclone hit Cape Breton Island, killing 500 people. On September 1st, L.C. Owen became the second premier of Prince Edward Island, and he would serve for 3 years until 1876. On September 23rd, the Canadian Labour Union is founded. This was the first attempt at a national central organization in Canada, and it would consist of 46 unions. Unfortunately, tough economic times would result in few unions existing by the end of the decade, and the organization would fade away in 1878. On October 4th, the Argonauts Football Club, which would one day become the Toronto Argonauts, was established. The football team would appear in the Grey Cup final 23 times and win a record 17 Grey Cups so far. On October 20th, Nellie McClung was born in Chatsworth, Ontario to John and Letitia Mooney, and following the failure of the family's farm, they moved to Manitoba. McClung would receive 6 years of education, but would not learn to read until she was 9. As an adult, she would campaign for the Liberal Party in 1915 and 1916 for the right for women to vote. She would organize the Women's Political Equity League, and in 1914, it would hold a mock parliament that was well publicized and would become a common tactic of suffragists elsewhere in Canada. In this mock parliament, suffragists would play the roles of politicians, with McClung mocking Sir Rodman Roblin, the Premier of Manitoba at the time, in her debate of whether or not men should be given the vote. McClung, during the 1914 election campaign, spoke 60 times in 2 months, sometimes 3 times a day, and she became a household name in the province, with some calling her Manitoba's prospective woman premier. Maclean's magazine would write, quote, "McClung has the courage of her convictions. You know the moment she mounts a platform and begins speaking, she speaks to you. This is her charm. Time, place, audience, and conventionalities all fade away, and there is no one but you and Nellie McClung speaking of things you should have known long ago, but did not," end quote. McClung would tell the members of the Manitoba legislature, quote, "Have we not the brains to think, hands to work, hearts to feel, and lives to live? Do we not bear our part in citizenship? Do we not help build the empire? Give us our due," end quote. Premier Roblin would respond that most women don't want the vote, stating, quote, "Now you forget all this nonsense about women voting. You're a fine, smart young woman. I can see that. And take it from me, nice women don't want the vote," end quote.
"I don't understand why women want to vote."
"Oh, really?"
The first time Nellie McClung saw the premier about votes for women,
"Things are changing. Good day, sir."
It didn't go too well for McClung.
"Take it from me, Mrs. McClung. Nice women don't want the vote."
So then she staged a mock parliament attacking votes for men.
"Think what would happen if we actually allowed men to vote. Why, they would become obsessed with politics. Politics are like drinks. Once you start, if men started voting, families would be disrupted. Divorces would follow." "Madam Speaker, take it from me. Nice men don't want the vote."
After a long campaign, Manitoba's women became the first to get the provincial vote.
"Thank you, dear. Nice to
the
see
next
you,
time
child.
They met, morning, in a polling gentlemen. Station, it didn't go too well for the premier.
"Premier Roblin, I'm sure you don't want your photograph taken with a woman who's not nice."
Thanks to the events such as the mock parliament, the 1915 Manitoba election would become a turning point in the movement in the West. The Manitoba Liberal Party promised to give women the right to vote, which gained it the support of suffragists throughout the province. The election would see the end of the conservative rule that had lasted since 1900, with the Liberals taking 40 of 47 seats. In December 1915, the Political Equity League of Manitoba delivered 40,000 signatures in support of women gaining the right to vote. The new Premier Norris would assure the women who gave him the petition that a bill was being prepared to give women the vote in Manitoba, and that he hoped to have it before the coming session of the legislature. The Liberal Party then made good on its promise by granting women the right to vote and hold provincial office on January 28, 1916. When the final vote was done on the new law, several seats in the legislature were set aside for women to sit at. As the bill was read for a third time, the women rose in the legislature and sang "O Canada," and then cheered the members of the legislature. The MPs then responded with a cheer of their own for the women. On January 28, 1916, Manitoba officially became the first province to give women the right to vote. By this point, though, McClung had moved to Edmonton. In 1921, she would be elected to the Alberta legislature as a Liberal, serving until 1926. In 1927, along with the other members of the Famous Five, Nellie McClung argued the person's case, which would be decided in 1929 with the ruling by the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council that legally recognized women as persons who could thereafter sit in the Senate of Canada.
Today, when the problems of government the world over are essentially human problems, and our very homes and all that we hold most sacred are threatened by appalling dangers from without and by subversive forces from within, it is well that our national existence should be fortified by the participation in its affairs of those who are so exceptionally qualified to contribute to human well-being and to the preservation of the foundations of home and community life. It is with thoughts and convictions such as these that on behalf of the Canadian Federation of Business and Professional Women's Clubs, I now unveil the tablet which the Federation has erected in honor of the five women whose names it records.
We now introduce one of the five women, an author, a well-known speaker, and the woman member of the Board of Governors of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, our own Mrs. Nellie L. McClung. Madam President, Mr. Prime Minister, fellow Canadians, I desire to thank the Prime Minister and the President, too, for their kind words. And I thank the Prime Minister still more for the kindness he showed to our little petition when it was just a little scrap of paper going the rounds and not very welcome anyplace. I also wish to thank Newton Wesley Rowell for his kindness in taking our petition to the Privy Council. And I also wish to thank Lord Sankey for his glorious decision. So clear-cut and unmistakable and unanswerable. I would like very much tonight, dear friends, if I could express the corporate mind, not only of the five of us, but of all the people who have advanced the cause of women by ways seen and unseen, the great unnumbered, unremembered, and unknown people who have done so much for us, the people whose names will never appear in the papers, people whose names we will never know. Because it has been a long task, because it has been an epic story, this rise of women. They had to begin from so far down. Women had first to convince the world that they had souls, and then that they had minds, and then it came on to this matter of political entity. And the end is not yet. We fear that there are still people who would sign a minority report. Now I do wish to pay my tribute of love and admiration to the other four women whose friendship I enjoyed and treasured, for their loyalty, for their love, and for their steadfastness, for their wonderful companionship, Mrs. McKinney, Mrs. Muir Edwards, and Mrs. Parlby, whose message you will hear just in a moment. And particularly, I wish to give my tribute of praise to our undaunted and indomitable and incomparable leader, Emily F. Murphy. She didn't care who got the honor. She was never one to care who got the vote of thanks. She would joyfully pin a medal anytime on somebody else. And you know, dear friends, I can't help but saying it now that we're all here together, that we would all be able to accomplish a great deal more if none of us cared who got the credit. And tonight, if she is listening, from some of the islands of the blessed. I'm sure that there is no person who will hear the words of this ceremony with a lighter and a merrier heart.
McClung would continue to be a popular and accomplished author through her life and would live until 1951, passing away at the age of 77. In 1954, she would be named a Person of National Historic Significance by the government, and her home in Calgary that she lived in from 1923 to the mid-1930s was designated as a heritage site, as were two other homes that she had lived in. On November 8th, Winnipeg would officially be incorporated into a city. It had started out as a fur trading fort and would eventually become one of the most important cities in Canada's West. On December 10, 1873, Gabriel Dumont called a meeting to form a new government for the Métis settlement at Saint-Laurent in what is now Saskatchewan, which was along the South Saskatchewan River. Chosen as the president of the council, Dumont and the government installed a Métis system of landholding and created a legal code. A constitution was even created by Dumont for the new government. The council also stated its loyalty to Canada and promised to disband as soon as a territorial government was established. The year the council was created, Dumont built his first log cabin in the area and began to state that his profession was that of a farmer. Almost as soon as the council was created, the Canadian government began to state that it was the sole governing authority for the region. Dumont would respond that he was simply forming a local government, not trying to form an independent nation. For the most part, the government accepted this. In fact, the British Secretary of the Colonies, upon learning about the Council of Saint-Laurent, stated, quote, "It would be difficult to take strong exception to the acts of a community which appears to have honestly endeavored to maintain order by the best means of its power," end quote. This would be the beginning of a path that would lead to the eventual Northwest Resistance 12 years later. It was also this year that Poundmaker was adopted by Crowfoot, the chief of the Blackfoot, which greatly increased his influence. Crowfoot had adopted Poundmaker after Crowfoot lost his son in a battle between the Cree and the Blackfoot as a means of replacing his fallen son. Crowfoot would give Poundmaker the name Wolf Thin Legs. I hope you enjoyed that episode and our look at 1873. Next week, we're of course looking at 1874. If you like, you can email me at craig@canadaehx.com. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is Craig Baird, CraigBaird, and I'm on Instagram at Bairdo37. As well, again, if you want to support the podcast, you can for as little as $3 a month. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. And you can donate to the podcast by going to CanadaEHX.com and clicking Donate. And I also want to thank all of my wonderful patrons. And I apologize if I get any names incorrect. Martin Straish, Sarah White, Tom McMillan, Mike Sullivan, Wendy Mills, Keelan Prignitz, Michael Matthews, Joanna Parker, Jeff Dahl, Vobbs, Robert Page, Richard T., Colin Johnson, Jeff Hershey, Kyle Murray, Steve Paikin, Matthew Gartho, Lionel Romaine, Dr. Bob Turner, Randy Hayden, Doug Campbell, Reg W., Deborah Carlson, Francis Helbling, Nixon Ree, Shannon Marshall, Clinton Martinez, Dimitri Chauve, Aaron O'Hara Myers, Robert Dunseith, Todd Casey, Catherine Roy, Luke S., J.P. Bear, Jason Hall, Phil Maynard, and Iris Gray. Information from Canadian Encyclopedia, Maclean, CBC, Wikipedia, Montreal Gazette, Winnipeg Free Press, Helena Herald, and the Ottawa Citizen. Thanks, and we'll see you again next time.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.